Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi there. You're listening to the New Books Network. I am Joe Krolder, and I'm speaking with Maeve Ryan, who has written a new book put out by Yale University Press with the title Humanitarian Governance and the British Anti-Slavery World System. Welcome to the New Books Network, Maeve.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So first question for you is, who is Maeve Ryan?
Well, that's a very profound question, Joe. I'm very lucky. I get to be two quite different things in my work. My job gives me the opportunity to be two different versions, I guess, of Maeve Ryan professionally. I wear these different hats and in that sense engage with very different areas of scholarship and engage with very different types of communities, so academic and non-academic. First and foremost, I'm a historian. I'm a historian of 19th century British history initially, a little bit of Irish history at the very beginning. I focus on British foreign policy, the British Empire, the history of diplomacy and international relations more broadly. Really interested in the emergence of the European empires in that period, really mostly after the French Revolution. I also think a lot about things like the hegemonic transition from the British Empire to what we saw with the United States in the 20th century, and bigger themes around the emergence of international order, statecraft, and strategy making right through the 20th century into the 21st century. So there's quite a lot of like different types of history in there. And I'm actually currently thinking a lot about climate change and international order and sort of the relationship between climate change and future international order, but really started off with my feet very much in the 19th century. But I also, the other hat that I wear is I'm a co-founder and the co-director of the Centre for Grand Strategy at King's College London. And in this role, I get to convene a very vibrant research community. It's one of our school's busiest. We're networked across King's College itself, networked in with colleagues in the UK and internationally. And I get to mentor quite a lot of early career academics and PhD students and convene research seminars on various different themes, things including, as I mentioned, world order, the history of British foreign policy, new program on the Indo-Pacific region, which for those of us who work in the strategic studies area, finally, this is a key emerging strategic theater in the coming decades. And through the center, I also run a series of policy engagement projects with UK government mostly, things like the FCDO, the Foreign Commonwealth and Development Office, the Ministry of Defence and the National Security Secretariat and the Cabinet Office. So the purpose of our centre is through three different routes, through education, research and engagement. The aim is to bring a greater degree of historical and strategic expertise to bear on contemporary policymaking and the doing of strategy in the present day. So I know that you've read the book and you're probably scratching your head about the connections between this sort of work and the book. In the book, which is very much a history based in the 19th century with some resonances in the present day, which I tried to draw out in the epilogue. But I'll just return to what I said before. I feel very fortunate that I've been able to carve out this twin track career, which is very, down in no small part to where I am at King's College London and the community, a very extraordinary, I think, an interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary group of scholars and former practitioners, and being mentored by them and guided by them has allowed me as a historian to really engage with and connect my work with questions in the present day. So I feel very fortunate. Does that answer your question?
Absolutely. I mean, to use a word that you just used, extraordinary, that that is the purpose of history, right? I mean, we're supposed to make connections and engage, and you're just living that dream. That's fantastic. When did you know that you actually wanted to become a historian?
Well, I don't think it took me a long time to be absolutely sure I wanted to pursue an academic career. But I knew that history was a passion of mine really early on. So I actually didn't study it in school. I studied physics, chemistry, math. But when I went to university, I decided to study history and English literature. My major was in history. And so this is a dual track degree at Trinity College Dublin. And I actually think I thought I wanted to be a journalist back in the day, but when I got there, I found the history department just completely beyond anything I had expected. It offered such a terrific program. And as my major, that was a 4-year degree. And the last 2 years of that, I was working under the mentorship of two extraordinary professors, Professor Jane Ohlmeyer and Professor Patrick Gagan. And the whole emphasis of what we were doing there was working with primary source material. And looking back on that, as you know, third and fourth year undergrads, actually we did some of this in second year too. It was amazing. So with Jane Ohlmeyer, who's a leading scholar of 17th century British Isles, we were working in the Trinity Long Library. For anyone who's been to Trinity College Dublin, this is the famous old library. We're working in there, you know, just for undergraduate seminars, working with the 1641 depositions in their original manuscript form. And equally with Professor Gagan, we're working on all sorts of primary material relating to Irish Revolutionary period, the Irish Act of Union and so on. And this is where I got the bug for history. My undergrad dissertation, I had the opportunity to just go across the road into the National Library of Ireland and work with a whole set of uncatalogued and completely underused manuscripts on topics relating to all of the shenanigans around the Irish Act of Union in 1801. And there, as a final year undergraduate student, just rummaging around looking for something for my undergrad dissertation, I found the first known documentary evidence of a piece of bribery being used by the anti-union side. It was a receipt for a bribe. We knew that bribes were being paid by the other side, but we'd never seen evidence that it was happening on the anti-union side. And that just gave me this love for the thrill, I guess, the detective work. It also gave me material for my first publication. So that was kind of what hooked me in. And this was, in a way, it was pure history, you know, really rummaging through the archives and looking for exciting new things. And I loved it. I loved pure history. But I was also really interested in thinking about ways to connect that with more contemporary questions. And I think now I realize that was a sort of an interest in applied history as a term, which I didn't know anything about at that point. But what I decided to do instead of pursuing a history, a direct kind of history master's track towards a PhD, I went to study an MPhil in international relations. I went to the University of Cambridge, and I was incredibly lucky to be supervised by Professor Brendan Sims there. And I took kind of a history track through that MPhil. He supervised some research that I did for my dissertation and suggested to me that I look at the diplomatic and international legal implications and consequences of Britain's abolition of the slave trade. This was around the time of the Bicentenary, and it was a big, you know, hot topic. And I thought, this sounds very interesting. So I already had that interest in British foreign policy and the history of diplomacy and what you might call statecraft. But then during this master's project, those interests came into contact with the history of slavery, the slave trade, and the emergence of ideas of humanitarian intervention and the development of governance systems as a result of some of these interventions. So for those listeners who maybe aren't so familiar with the abolition of the slave trade and it's sort of the early history of this, when the British passed the 1807 Abolition Act, this is a piece of domestic UK law abolishing Britain, the involvement of Britons in the transatlantic slave trade. It became illegal for Britons to engage in slave trading and for slave ships to pass through British territorial waters or for British flagged ships to trade in slaves on the high seas. And so after 1807, when the Act came into force in 1808, the Royal Navy was sent out and they were seizing slave ships on the coast of West Africa, partly in British territorial waters, waters claimed colonially by the British, and often on the high seas. And the complicating factor of this is that in 1808, as people might be aware, this is during the period of the wars against France, the Napoleonic Wars. And so for the first 7 or so years of this campaign against the slave trade, the British had an expansion expanded set of legal rights to seize slave ships on the high seas, as long as they were flagged, the flag that they were flying was that of a belligerent power, or in those wars, or was a neutral suspected of in some way supporting the opposing side. So the British were engaging in this naval suppression campaign, and Brendan Sims' prompt to me was, you know, his suggestion to me was to look into this. You know, there's this assumption that this created diplomatic problems for the United Kingdom, you know, sending Royal Navy ships seizing what was essentially other people's private property. Had this created problems? Was it more than just a few angry diplomatic notes? Did it go deeper than that? And so I was looking at this and not finding really evidence of really significant costs paid by Britain for this. And then thinking a bit about what this told us about the slow emergence of norms in the international system against slave trading and ultimately against slavery as an institution. But in the course of that research, I became really interested in what wasn't really talked about in some of those diplomatic and legal histories, which was what happened when those ships that had been seized on the high seas, when they were brought ashore and they went through this legal process, what happened to the human cargoes on board those ships? And so I started looking into this more from my PhD topic. And from there, you know, this is where the book emerged from.
This is, just to remind listeners, this is Joe Crowder. I'm talking with Maeve Ryan, who has recently published with Yale University Press, Humanitarian Governance in the British Anti-Slavery World System. And Maeve, there's a couple of things that you hit upon that I want to get back to. And one of them is the archives. I mean, the place where we just get turned on as historians. I mean, it's just the things that we find and locate. And in your book, I noted that you've got European archives, you've got Caribbean archives, you've got North American archives, you've got even African archives in Sierra Leone. Did you go to all these places?
I went to most of these places, and I had the great good fortune of having extremely helpful archivists and also friends in the academic community who shared with me copies of some that I couldn't get hold of personally. So I spent quite a lot of time in Sierra Leone, and I've also traveled to North America. Really, the ones that I struggled to get to in person were the archives in the Bahamas, but I have been to Cuba, and my hope had been to actually go to Zanzibar. That was my original plan, was to, as part of the expansion of from what had been the PhD project into this wider book, I'd intended to go to Zanzibar and look at some of the material related to liberated Africans in the Indian Ocean. But I was also very fortunate to meet Matthew Hopper, who's done a lot of really great work on liberated Africans in the Indian Ocean, and actually realized he was very generous and very kindly shared a lot of material with me. But I also realized that he was more than covering this, so I was able to focus my energies much more in the Atlantic world. And I'm grateful for that, because I think the book is a stronger project as a result.
I think it's a fantastic book. And I want to start with the title, because I need to, after reading your book, I need to reset the listeners' minds as to what humanitarianism meant in the early 19th century, because it's decidedly not how we perceive it today in the 21st. So what is this humanitarian governance that you have written so wonderfully about?
Well, so there were a few things to say about that, really. So first of all, humanitarianism, and I would point out that this doesn't mean the same thing. It actually wasn't, I use the term in the book, but I do flag this in the introduction, that this wouldn't necessarily have been a term used by contemporaries about themselves. You know, it's actually the term humanitarianism was often used kind of humanitarian, actually, to describe a person was often used pejoratively in the earliest period. And there's really interesting things to say around that. But one of the things I was trying to do with this book was to interrogate and get a deeper understanding of the earliest origins of humanitarianism. And I was building here on Michael Barnett's work, his groundbreaking book, Empire of Humanity. And he looks at modern day humanitarianism, which, you know, listeners might be familiar with, kind of manifests in two ways that he identifies. One, that emergency kind of humanitarianism. So, you know, disaster relief, you know, flying out supplies to a place where there's just been a typhoon or a hurricane or earthquake or something, establishing that kind of temporary relief and support. So that sort of emergency intervention, you know, to address urgent need. And then what he calls alchemical, and what this means really is sort of developmental or about more slowly changing and adapting a situation. That type of humanitarianism is a bit more in that kind of development space. So changing the conditions that have been creating whatever the urgent human need is. And, you know, he identifies these as two quite separate strands of humanitarianism, and I'd certainly agree with that. And he identifies two different points of origin for those. And what I do with this book is I build upon this a little bit and I bring it back slightly further and say, actually, I think that they both emerged in the same place. That, you know, the Battle of Solferino isn't the first place we see this emergency intervention, and equally the abolition of the slave trade, or rather the abolition of slavery and the kind of developmental piece around that isn't where we first see that developmental humanitarianism. But actually, if you go a little bit further back to about 1808, you start to see these experiments that emerge as a result of the Abolition Act of 1807. And the point of origin is really the same for both. And the point of origin I identify is this network, or what I consider like an archipelago, a connected network all over the Atlantic world and the Indian Ocean of these liberated African establishments, where both the emergency needs of people who are being brought ashore from slave ships, but also the more developmental, society-changing, remolding type work is being done in kind of the same institution and using the same bureaucratic infrastructure. And on the definitional point about humanitarian governance, just to mention that humanitarian governance is a term I use throughout the book. But just to be clear, I use it in the sense of discourse and stated aims rather than measurable humanitarian outcomes. So it's really about the approach and the intent. And it's used to refer to the framing of types of imperial and colonial governance and those sorts of experiments in a language of a higher moral purpose. So it's identifying where there's a pursuit of what would be considered by those individuals to be kind of humanitarian goals, although they would not necessarily have used that term. They would think of it as altruistic or benevolent goals, using the exercise of state power and designing interventions on the basis of human need, but using what, and I'm borrowing a term here from Alan Lester and Faye Dussart, use a term like articulating what they're trying to do in a moral vernacular. So this is how I'm defining humanitarian governance.
And that clearly comes through in the book. And it's the roots of abolitionism that has always sparked my interest. Now, I'm an 18th century guy. So, you know, I read John Wesley's Thoughts on Slavery, published 1774. George Whitefield had, you know, letters to the inhabitants of Maryland, Virginia, North and South Carolina, 1740s. These evangelical roots are so profound in abolitionists, this, as you put it, moral panic. So we get to the Slave Trade Abolition Act of 1807, but there's a whole lot of work that went on prior to that. I'm wondering if you could kind of clear that up a little bit for people who don't really understand the roots of abolitionism.
Yeah, sure. So there's a couple of things. I mean, there's so many things I'd like to say about this. It's such a fascinating question. You know, it is honestly such a fascinating question. Why in this, let's say, Western world, just for the sake of giving it a shorthand, this kind of Anglo-American world, to a lesser extent across some of the European states, why do we see this post-Enlightenment articulation, very strong articulation post-Enlightenment of the early seeds of a kind of anti-slavery impetus when slavery is part of human society and human civilization for, you know, thousands of years? We go back to the earliest cuneiform inscriptions and we see references to slaves, we see references to people being taken in war and enslaved. So it's kind of profoundly odd that at a particular moment and really quite quickly, there is this pivot, what seems like a pivot in terms of the acceptability, the moral acceptability of slavery. And lots of people have grappled with this question. And one person I would point to, maybe above all others, I think that the giant on whose shoulders most of us try to stand when we understand this question is David Brian Davis, whose work is written several books, as I'm sure you're very familiar, has written several books interrogating this question, one of which, Slavery and Human Progress, I think it's called, is particularly interesting, but really trying to grapple with that question in the age of revolutions, where this comes from. And the simple answer is, I think there's probably still no consensus on this. Is it, you know, traceable to elements of a religious revival? Certainly the evangelical dimension is important. Is it traceable to just changing ideas, during the Enlightenment, sort of changing ideas about the nature of the individual? It's really quite difficult to say. I mean, it can be in some communities possibly ascribed to multiple factors. It's possible that some in a community were motivated by, say, religious imperatives. Others were interested in being part of a kind of fashion. You know, you could even see an element of virtue signaling, as we would call it in the present day, although it's a horrifying anachronism to talk about it in the past. But, you know, we see these huge numbers of petitions being sent back, you know, these petition scrolls going around the whole of the UK or Britain, and, you know, looking for this sort of mass consensus and these petitioning campaigns being led by abolitionists, but going to every village hall and trying to whip up this local level support, this grassroots support for what became the Abolition Act of 1807. And those, you know, again, speaking about the archives, you can go to the National Archives today and you can look at these, and it's a real profound testament. Some extraordinary, I can't remember actually what the exact proportion of the population that signed these petitions were, but it's extraordinarily high proportion. So, you know, trying to interrogate what it was that motivated these people and animated these people is fascinating. One other thing I would mention is the timing of the final success of the abolitionists, because obviously it was a slow and incremental process where, you know, when you look at the legal record, a number of different legal instruments are being created and passed and going through legislatures, not just in Britain, but elsewhere in this period towards the end of the 18th century, start of the 19th century. One of the things that Christopher Leslie Brown has pointed to in his work, Moral Capital, is the question of the importance or the significance for Britons of the loss of the American colonies, as we like to refer to it, as you like to call it, independence. How much did that matter that this kind of body blow to British self-image and prestige had happened, the loss of these colonies, a very controversial set of events within Britain that had profound consequences for Britain's own domestic politics and really divided opinion. After that, I mean, there's one theory, one interpretation of all of this is after the loss of those colonies and in America's, the United States' decision to go it alone on their own path, that there was, an incentive for Britons to start to identify reasons why they were different and reasons why they were better, and to point to the ongoing slaveholding character of the United States and the defense of slavery by many of the leading figures within that political establishment, and to start to think about, you know, grounds for feeling morally superior. I mean, certainly this is an argument that's tested in Christopher Leslie Brown's work, among others, and I think it's quite an interesting thread to pull.
Yeah, I need to kind of also put this in time, in the sense that, okay, we have the Sierra Leone Company. They request Britain to please take charge of this operation here. It's costing us too much money. And once the state chose to run this colony, Sierra Leone, once these captured slave ships are brought into Freetown, we get customs officials that are now responsible for sheltering, feeding, distributing these liberated Africans. And that just struck me that it was customs officials that are doing this. And I wondered what does this say about the culture of 1808, about how liberated Africans were perceived by the British state, indeed its society at the same time, despite what abolitionists were doing.
You've picked up on a really important point there, which is the characterization of enslaved people on slave ships. When you look at the Abolition Act, the text of this Abolition Act that passed the Houses of Parliament in 1807, there are, I think it's 27 articles in this act, and 26 of them relate to the inanimate elements of the slave ship, so that the ship itself and the the inanimate cargo and so on. It also relates to the legal instruments and activities required to render this ship as prize, the bounties that would be paid to the captors, and these bounties were paid partly to incentivize Royal Navy officers to engage in this interdiction, as we call it, the sort of seizure of property. So 26 of the 27 articles relate to this. Only one relates to the people on board. And that to me is quite interesting and is quite revealing. The journey that the people go on, sort of legal journey, is rendered from being considered private property as would any other trade good, to then being transformed legally by the courts established through the Abolition Act. So in the first instance, Vice Admiralty courts, and later mixed commission courts representing the different states involved in a bilateral treaty. But in the first instance, just British Vice Admiralty courts. These courts were established and empowered to do this kind of legal chicanery, really, to transform these people from legally bought and sold property in the eyes of the law to something else, to people. And so the presence or the role of the collector of customs in any harbor or port to which a captured slave ship was brought, it's logical in that kind of if you get yourself into the mindset of the people who are framing this act. You know, it's obviously abhorrent to our modern day sensibilities, but it is logical to them because it all fit in that space of seizure of property and prize, turning things into prize in a time of war. And so, as I show in the book, Sierra Leone, it kind of looms large in this book because it's an interesting and one of the largest and most complex elaboration of one of these establishments created to administer and to first of all, address the urgent emergency feeding and sheltering needs, clothing needs, but then also to facilitate the integration of these survivors of the slave trade into colonial society. So in Sierra Leone, you see initially the collector of customs doing this work, completely overwhelmed very, very quickly. And then you see within a few years, actually not immediately, but after a huge amount of human suffering and upheaval and tragedy, the metropolitan British government and the parliament eventually vote to create a kind of bureaucratic infrastructure, a department for what were called ended up being called the Liberated African Department. In other sites around the Atlantic world, there are places where ships are being brought ashore, including in the British West Indies and in Cape Town and Cape Colony, modern day Cape Town, and eventually St. Helena in the South Atlantic. And varying degrees of complexity of what kind of infrastructure is created in those places. In some of those places, it's very rudimentary, and it stays quite rudimentary for most of the period.
Yeah, I'd like to get to those, but I want to stick with Sierra Leone for a couple of minutes, because I think our listeners might need some background as to how Britain actually acquired Sierra Leone and the early purposes of it. And there's a Halifax connection, and that Halifax connection goes to, the American War for Independence. And wondered if you could speak to that real quick.
Sure. So the colony of Sierra Leone is quite unusual in that it was founded as a private venture in 1787, I believe. And it was founded by abolitionists and, through a private subscription and so on, not a crown endeavor. And for those who are interested in the expansion of the British Empire more broadly, while this is an unusual thing and, an experimental colony founded expressly to create a kind of planted settlement of anti-slavery values on the west coast of Africa, so it was in the promotional literature, this sort of accidental, inverted commas, expansion of territory is echoed actually more broadly across the empire. So quite often things are opened up by traders as they saw it, and then situations are created and the thing becomes less viable, and local actors seek to kind of undermine or to remove the colonists, and then the crown comes in. So actually that pattern is repeated quite frequently across the British Empire, and Sierra Leone in that sense follows that pattern. So it's established as a private enterprise. As I say, it's by abolitionists. The idea is to prove the viability of free labor. And so they're going to plant this little colony on the peninsula of Sierra Leone. Anyone who's ever been to Sierra Leone will know that it's this little peninsula, very mountainous, which is where the name comes from. And it's at the mouth of this estuary, a deep water port. And in lots of sense, I mean, for those who know the geography of West Africa, know that quite a lot of the West African coast is kind of beaches and sandbars, and quite difficult to navigate for the sorts of ships and transport systems that were available at the time. So Sierra Leone offers some really unusual opportunities, but this was the idea, that it was going to be this planted colony, and it was supposed to show, through kind of model communities and so on, it was supposed to show the viability of free labor. If slavery didn't exist, look what people could do, essentially. It was quite difficult to populate that colony and keep it populated. The initial group of people who were sent out did not thrive. The land had been apparently supposedly handed over by agreement, that didn't last. And so, and also during the wars with France and with others during the Napoleonic Wars, you had a few attacks on the settlement. And so it wasn't thriving, it was being attacked, and it was, generally speaking, not proving particularly successful. And so you had a few injections, attempts by abolitionists and the directors of this company to bring over more settlers and to shore up that ailing colony. And one of those groups was a group called the Nova Scotians, who were otherwise known as Black Loyalists, and families coming over after the War of Independence, those who'd been promised their freedom, enslaved people who'd been promised their freedom if they fought on the side of the British, then transplanted over to Sierra Leone to live in this colony. Equally, another group of Maroons. So these were people brought over from Jamaica, I believe, maybe a decade or so, 2 decades later. And so there's a pre-existing colony there before the liberated Africans are brought ashore. And this is one of the reasons why when the Abolition Act passes and comes into force in 1808, Sierra Leone is seen as a viable and sensible place by these abolitionists to bring the slave ships and to liberate these enslaved people. And it was seen as not just an available site where there's a deep water port and the Navy ships could come ashore. It was also seen as an opportunity to populate the colony with, young, healthy, labor-ready individuals whose work could be used to shore up and make that experiment more viable.
So the state takes over 1807-1808, and a governor is appointed, Thomas Perronet Thompson. And I kind of read your account here, and he comes across, and I might be wrong on this, so correct me, but he comes across as kind of a hero type figure. He's like way ahead of his time. And I was wondering, did he misinterpret his orders? Was he a true abolitionist rather than someone who was, supposed to follow what the government wanted? He says there's moral limits to what we're doing here. He was kind of concerned.
That's interesting that he comes across as kind of a hero. It wasn't really my intent. I find him a really interesting character. Not that he's I'm not trying to say that he's sort of the villain here, but he's a very interesting character. And Patrick Scanlon's work, he has a book out a couple of years before mine, I think, called Freedom's Debtors. He goes into this particular character in much more depth. And I've found his research quite useful in this regard. But it's really difficult to get to grips with exactly what this man's personality was. When you read his letters, he occasionally comes across as quite unhinged and very angry and very, extremely determined to criticize what he found, everything he found, and to call the attention of the Secretary of State to the corruption and malpractice that he believed to have found. So let's go back a second. So the passage of the Abolition Act happens in 1807, and then in 1808 the thing comes into force. But separately, and it's a separate process, the directors of the Sierra Leone Company persuade the British Parliament to accept responsibility for the colony. And this is actually quite contentious, but it does get passed. And one of the arguments for this is that actually so many individuals have been brought over, both from the UK, from Nova Scotia, and from Jamaica. And so there were actually some pre-existing groups of settlers there who needed support. And it would be wrong for the British state to just kind of walk away and wash their hands of it, albeit the colony had proven extremely expensive. It had been subsidized by the state for quite a while. Anyway, it becomes a crown colony that comes into force. And so there is this kind of odd overlap period where the first slave ships are being brought to Sierra Leone. And it's a Sierra Leone company governor who's administering this. And then it's Thomas Parnett Thompson who comes over and he takes over as the first crown colony governor. He arrives there and he immediately is asking questions about what happened to the first people who were landed from the first ships. And what he finds is that actually those first, the first couple of hundred or so individuals are essentially treated as slaves. So the Abolition Act only allows, when I mentioned there was one article in the Abolition Act that dealt with and provided for what should happen to these individuals released from the slave ships, that article provided only two routes. One is apprenticeship and one is enlistment in the armed forces. And apprenticeship is essentially like indentured servitude, and it's supposed to be time limited. Enlistment was supposed to be for life and without pension, so not a great deal. And already, you know, when you think this is all, these are the only two routes that were allowed for, and this is what the collector of customs was supposed to do: take these people, give them some clothes, give them some food, and as quickly as possible get them off the government books by handing them out as indentured laborers or handing them over to the army, or to a lesser extent to the navy, and that was it. So when this new Crown Colony governor arrives, he finds that the people, most of the people who had been apprenticed in this way had not experienced a kind of different condition to what a slave would have experienced, and many of whom had actually run away and been recaptured and thrown into the jail. And he's horrified by this. He professes to be horrified by the whole idea of apprenticeship. He says it goes against the spirit of anti-slavery, against the spirit of the Abolition Act. And he initially professes to believe that the abolitionists in the UK, and who had actually endorsed him and had kind of groomed him for this role and sent him out there, he's young, he's in his 20s, and I think he's the son of a friend of one of the prominent abolitionists, and I think he was seen as kind of a malleable new crown governor, and in fact the opposite is true. He sees these people maybe initially as misguided and deluded, they've been deceived by the people on the ground in the colony, and it had all been done differently to how they expected, but over time quickly he comes to see them as the bad guys, really. You know, that people like Zachary Macaulay, who's quite prominent in this period, one of the leading abolitionists, that he is, you know, conspiring and conniving to perpetuate slavery in West Africa under the guise of abolitionism. And I don't know, it's hard to tell from Thompson's correspondence on this, because he's writing these increasingly fevered letters to Castlereagh, Secretary of State. He's writing to his girlfriend, and it just becomes across as more and more paranoid and conspiratorial. Although, you know, you also can read into it the kind of scales falling away from the eyes of this young impressionable person who believed, you know, everything he had been told about anti-slavery. So yeah, it's quite hard to judge, but he does push back quite hard, and he puts his career on the line. And ultimately gets recalled. I mean, he goes on to have quite a successful career elsewhere, but he is recalled in disgrace. I don't think the Secretary of State ever bothers to answer any of his letters.
You're listening to the New Books Network. This is Joe Crowder. I'm talking with Maeve Ryan, whose new book is out, Humanitarian Governance and the British Anti-Slavery World System. One of the people that put Thompson in charge of the governorship was William Wilberforce. And I guess sitting back and looking at Wilberforce's very famous name, by the way, I'm looking at this, and one of the things that he's telling his new governors is, you know, there's some short-term moral compromises that we have to make here for these long-term benefits of these liberated Africans. It brings up this term that you call gradualism, and it comes up again and again and again, and it's like abolitionism, yeah, but it turns into sort of a gradual goal. It's not something so immediate, and that's what I found so intriguing about this book, is how that kind of morphed forward. Do you care to respond to that at all?
Sure. I mean, one of the things that motivated me to write this book was to try to understand some of the apparent contradictions and tensions here. You know, there's some very strong professed moral imperatives behind all of this. And the language abolitionists use in their communications and their pamphlets and so on, it really suggests a kind of an engagement with the plight of the enslaved person at that really human level, and the need to, you know, to do something to save these people. You know, it really, that's what comes across as sort of messaging. But it became clear to me, you know, when I really early on started asking this question, okay, but what happened to the people liberated from the slave ships? It became clear to me that the intervention wasn't actually about saving them. You know, it was about, you know, for the abolitionists, for those early elite abolitionists, the kind of parliamentarians like Wilberforce and others, people involved very closely in drafting the Abolition Act and in figuring out what this, what we call the disposal policy, that disposal of liberated people through either apprenticeship or enlistment. These elite abolitionists like Wilberforce had their fingerprints all over this. They wrote this because, and it wasn't, they didn't just go along with it. They were deeply involved in crafting this. And, you know, it became clear to me through really looking a lot at their correspondence, their published writings, and looking at how things played out. For them, it was about crushing the trade and the humanity they were imagining. You know, they used the middle passage, that bit of the triangular slave trade system, the bit between West Africa and the Americas, the bit that, you know, where individual people were being packed onto these slave decks, and, you know, the survivors being sold into, you know, plantation slavery with a life expectancy that was very, very short. And so this absolutely awful, awful, awful human kind of tragedy that's happening in the middle passage. Abolitionists are focusing on this, they're interested in it, and they use it as an emotive tool to try to get people to understand what the slave trade is, and what some of the kind of human cost of their sugar is and so on. But they didn't, it seems to me anyway, that they weren't actually that focused on saving the people who were on those slave ships. For them, it was about destroying that system, you know, ending the kind of, preventing the future enslavement of others, making sure that Africans stayed in the continent of Africa and were able to, you know, again, free labor rather than enslaved labor, and prove that kind of slavery isn't necessary for the functioning of the global economy and so on and so on. So it wasn't, when the slave ships were coming ashore, these liberated Africans were kind of at best incidental to the whole enterprise, I think, and at worst potentially tools to serve a wider purpose. And it's not, this isn't just that they were forgotten. The key point is that abolitionists were really quite alarmed at the idea of just taking enslaved people from a slave ship, putting them ashore and allowing them to be free. It was quite a scary prospect for them, because if you think, for many of the years of the abolition campaign, the abolition of the slave trade, it starts effectively in 1808. You know, for the first few decades, right up to 1833, slavery itself, the institution of slavery, is still legal in the British Empire. So other than Sierra Leone, the rest of the British Empire is legally, you know, slavery is still a legal institution. There's no legal slavery in the islands of metropolitan Britain, but elsewhere it's kind of fair game, more or less. And so the rationale for continuing that enslavement of Africans, even though for decades Britons had been quite, you know, clear on the idea that they thought slave trade was terrible and slavery was, you know, morally quite repugnant, actually the preservation of that institution of slavery relied upon narratives about the capacity of enslaved people for full freedom. So the rationale was for them that enslaved people, people who had been enslaved, were unable to support themselves. They needed to be schooled to reacquire their freedom. And I think that's actually a quote, more or less a direct quote. They needed to be schooled to reacquire the capacity for freedom and to, you know, to be integrated into colonial societies. But really, I mean, the problem was that just liberating people from slave ships and allowing them to live freely was just, you know, was quite challenging. So it avoided an awkward conversation about why enslaved people landed from a slave ship in Sierra Leone were capable of living independently, but those laboring in the West Indies or elsewhere were not. And it was, you know, and that disposal system, that policy was also about assimilating these enslaved people to British folkways. So it's like integrating them into the colonial economy, preventing them for quite a long time, that those who came to Sierra Leone were prevented by the colonial authorities from just migrating back to where they had come from, especially those who'd come from, you know, the nearby, clearly wanted to go back to their homes. And for many, there was this attempt to prevent that from happening, partly, as I said, to sort of shore up that colonial labor system, and also partly to prove the viability of free labor.
Okay, thanks, Maeve. The gradualism thing.
Sorry, I didn't address your gradualism point.
Yes. Yeah. It really hit home for me, because I think this is very transatlantic. It's also transnational. I mean, in the United States, early on, even before the United States became the United States, there was movements to make sure that emancipation occurred, but over time, after there was significant training to become more, within the cultural guidelines at the time. I think you put it on page 40 that these liberated Africans must be trained gradually so that they could become more British or become cognizant of the empire and the good that it was doing. It's just remarkable to me, you know, how much of that is going around at this time.
It's an important part of a lot of, I think, you know, if you kind of zoom out a little bit and look at movements towards really quite significant and painful structural change, where people need to make painful adjustments to their lives. I mean, the obvious one, I think, is probably climate change. You know, trying to get people to think differently about how they're consuming and using and creating resources, and actually make quite substantial changes. It does lend itself to it, making it easier for people to adapt to that. The kind of gradualism argument is employed. And I think, you know, even for it is extraordinary in Britain and the United States too, when you look at the work of anti-slavery campaigners and some of the, especially some of those transatlantic linked organizations, you see different types of rationale for extending, you know, and changing the nature of slavery rather than getting rid of it. So in the 1820s, you see this campaign for the amelioration of slavery, so making the conditions of enslaved people better. You start to see things like, not just in British Empire, you start to see or in the United States, things like around free womb laws emerging at different times in the 19th century, this idea that children would of enslaved women wouldn't be born as slaves. So lots of different adjustments to and tinkering with the problem of slavery and trying to make the maybe some of the moral repugnance around it get a bit closer to what's perceived as the reality of it. But then, you know, then there's the contrary to that, you get these imperatives for just accelerating. And so you see pamphlets, especially towards the late 1820s, people like Elizabeth Herrick, I think, calling for an immediate, not gradual end to slavery. And actually then as you get closer to the 1833 passage of the Emancipation Act in the British Parliament, you start to see some of this getting a bit more traction, that actually things haven't changed. Abolishing the slave trade, cutting off the supply didn't kind of gradually allow the plantations to adapt in a slow way and a kind of an economically stable way to free labor. It just didn't happen. And so abolitionists, those who are interested in removing slavery as an institution from the world economic system, just say, well, you know, now it's time to kind of, now it's just time to cut it off. And that's considered hugely problematic by a lot of people who still, even decades later, aren't ready for the abolition of slavery. And that's one of the reasons you see the passage of an extraordinary historic amount of compensation money, £20 million in the British currency of 1833, is voted to compensate the owners of enslaved people. So those who had owned them and were losing access to that after the period of transition up to 1838. And actually, there's an amazing project. Your listeners might be interested in this, especially those who've got any British relatives or heritage. There is an amazing project that was run out of the University College London called Legacies of British Slave Ownership. And it was run by a professor called Catherine Hall and her colleagues. And the idea behind it was they went into the National Archives in Kew in London, and they found all of the documentary evidence of who had been paid what compensation payments. So you can look up a family and you can find out, you know, did they own, you know, 10 slaves, or did they kind of own a share in a slave or whatever it was. You get people all over the country, all over Ireland too, claiming these compensation payments, again, because of this approach to, you know, gradual change, and then create this kind of financial cushion to try to absorb the blow of that economic transition away from slavery. It doesn't work, really, but you can see the thinking behind it is very much geared towards that.
Yeah, geared, I guess, towards frustration. I mean, coming back a little bit, you have these captured slave ships. Britain brings them in to Sierra Leone. Over a while, you point out that there's over 100 spoken languages among these captured and non-liberated Africans. And I'm wondering how language became a barrier towards the attitudes towards these liberated Africans, because I see it happening in your book in Sierra Leone, in Gambia, in St. Helena. was that so problematic that?
I think it's a problem that manifests itself in different ways in different locations. So if we just talk about Sierra Leone for a moment, this is where by far the greatest number of people were brought. And so, and it's also, you know, as I mentioned, it's got this expressly anti-slavery legal personality to it from the outset. It doesn't mean that people don't experience or in slavery. And actually, there's a lot of contemporary concern about the extent to which slavery is happening kind of out of sight in this colony. But it is this, you know, it has that kind of unique character and personality to it. And so you have all of these different cultures arriving in Sierra Leone. And actually, people go out there in this period to study and to understand, like, you know, linguists and anthropologists going out there to study and to understand some of these cultures, and to try to document and record and create, create like dictionaries of languages that they hadn't codified or studied before. So it's considered extremely interesting as a space. I mean, obviously it creates a number of challenges. And one of the things that happens in the, not immediately, but in the early decades, one of the governors takes this idea of creating model communities out of liberated Africans, recognizing that the apprenticeship and enlistment options weren't actually really working for Sierra Leone. It wasn't enough. Lots of people were arriving from slave ships, not in a healthy state, not able to, physically able to just be put straight to work in some way. Many are children. For listeners who aren't aware, I'm going to give you a little slight content warning. I'm going to describe a slave ship deck to you. Sometimes, you know, not very high, certainly not high enough for someone to stand up in. Quite often people packed in, really jammed in, and, you know, forced to lay down, even shackled, and, you know, packed in essentially like bales of hay almost, and then left in this position without being given an opportunity to move very much for long periods of time. Obviously seasickness, the darkness, the heat. There's a lot of, there's a lot, it's a very dangerous and disease-ridden sort of space. There's a lot of human excrement and vomit and so on. People emerge from this space very, very unwell. And there are some graphic descriptions documented by colonial surgeons and others who were witnessing this and writing down the sorts of illnesses and injuries, kind of crush injuries as well, created by especially smaller people like children and smaller adults being crushed as the ships are pitching and rolling. So, you know, these people have been through profound trauma. They're not, physical and emotional, psychological trauma. They're not necessarily going to be, you know, labor ready in the first instance. So in Sierra Leone, it takes a while, but this starts to manifest in different kinds of governance practices that deviate from the stated policy. And one of the governors that embarks in one of these is a governor called Charles McCarthy, who has these really utopian, grandiose ideas of what you might consider kind of developmental imperialism. And he has this idea, which he inherits from a few of his predecessors, to create these model villages, to set these out in a kind of British, to set them out to look aesthetically like a model British village with a church at the center of the village and a ticking clock and everybody dressed in British clothes and wearing the hats and all this kind of thing. So it's supposed to aesthetically mimic this kind of British idealized Christianized community, and they experiment with different ways to govern this. One of the systems that they use, they develop a partnership with the Church Missionary Society, and these missionaries come out from actually a lot of them from Germany and through the auspices of the Church Missionary Society, a few British too. They come out and their church, their kind of religious role is twinned with a secular role as the managers of these villages, and they're supposed to have oversight and this kind of paternalistic guidance role, but also the opportunity to act as disciplinarians and so on to try to keep people in check and to force really the creation of this community as much as is possible. So, in so doing, some of the villages were set up with distinct language groups, and so people from different because enslaved people on the transatlantic slave trade, you know, were being taken from not just coastal communities, but you know, even further inland. And you know, we know from some of the projects that have looked at African names and have also taken some DNA samples and so on from the remains of people who we know to have been victims of the slave trade. We know that people are coming from everywhere, from Senegal, maybe even north of Senegal, down to Angola and even further south and really quite far inland. So you've got these really diverse language groups and sometimes being crafted consciously into their own distinct groups. And sometimes it was a ship, you know, a ship together would be sent to form a village. And it really kind of varied. But we do know that one of the ways that that liberated Africans themselves accommodated this or adapted to this was that they formed what we call benefit societies. And sometimes these benefit societies would be around ethnic groups. But most people, it seems, came from ships, maintained a bond with the people who had survived the slave ship with them. And those benefit societies could be mutual support societies, you know, financial assistance when someone fell into hardship and so on and so on. So yeah, it's really interesting in different ways to navigate this. I would say that the colonial sources, the archival sources created by the empire and by its agents probably had like no visibility really comparatively of how this was all done. They weren't particularly interested, I think, beyond the challenges of just governing and controlling.
We're going to shift real quickly here because we're running out of time. One of the most interesting aspects of this is that this experiment, I'm going to call it that, in Sierra Leone is kind of exported elsewhere. The British West Indies, there's the Bahamas and then there's Trinidad. And I'm wondering if you could show that huge variance of what happened to these liberated Africans in just those two places.
Sure, yeah. What I tried to do in the book is kind of tease out the difference in what were the likely outcomes for an individual depending on where they went. So I point to what I call this archipelago of different establishments. And that includes the Gambia River, it includes the West Indies and various different sites around the Caribbean and so on, and as well as St. Helena and Cape Town. And the point that I'm kind of making here, one of the points I'm making is the difference between what happened to people who were brought to a slave-owning society or a society where slavery was, you know, deeply part of the economic makeup of the place and places where that wasn't the case. And so, looking at the Bahamas, for example, in the Bahamas, you see really quite different approaches to what you see in Trinidad. Trinidad, plantation economy, labor hungry, and especially after the end of legal slavery in the British Empire, increasingly struck with labor shortages and problems around labor supply on those sugar plantations. Conversely, in the Bahamas, is known, there's a term, I'm trying to remember who actually said this, we call the Sierra Leone of the Northern Caribbean, because you see there a little smaller scale experiments to what you see in Sierra Leone, but really experiments in resettling in groups of people in these kind of villages without disposing of them, inverted commas, as apprentices or as enlisted people, but actually resettling them in a village with some degree, perhaps even quite high degree of autonomy and the ability to control their own sort of destinies. And so in the Bahamas, you see like much smaller scale to what we see in Sierra Leone. I suppose one of the points that I make in this part of the book is it's not an experiment that necessarily lasts, and that after 1835 or so, and especially as this labor shortage is starting to bite, there are demands from other islands for any future liberated Africans to be brought there rather than to the Bahamas, where there's a certain amount of resentment amongst the local colonial population that these free liberated people are being allowed to form their own settlements there. And so in 1835, there's a passage of a new treaty between Britain and Spain, and a new slave trade abolition treaty, which changes a little bit the nature of the agreement that had previously existed. And it basically allows Britain to take liberated Africans from Havana who were liberated by the courts there through their bilateral treaty, to take those liberated Africans and resettle them in British territories. And there's a bit of a tussle between the different types of colony about where they should go. And one of the colonial governors in the Bahamas, he's making a case for how it's absolutely in the interest of these individuals that they be brought to the Bahamas where they can live this more independent life and where they, their predecessors have proven themselves able to do so. And then the demands coming from those colonies with labor shortages and that kind of sugar plantation output demand. So
tell me, Maeve, what's next for you?
What is next? So I've got another book in the works, which is called Subtle Consul. And I'm looking at the emergence of the modern consular service. I'm really interested in the different roles that consuls played in different sites. During the research for this book, for a humanitarian governance book, I came across a lot of consular sources, especially in Brazil and in Cuba and elsewhere, where they were one of the primary sources of information gathering, playing a kind of low-level diplomacy role. Even when diplomatic relations had broke down a bit, colonial consuls often were able to maintain a sort of presence and certainly the ability to influence things at that lower level. So kind of a consular officer blends that trade and diplomatic role a little bit and that information gathering. So I've just become really interested in the role that they have played in the emergence of what we call the informal empire. So really at that kind of peripheries of what Britain is doing. So there's that. I'm also working on a project on war and slavery because I'm in a Department of War Studies. I've realized that there are so many interconnections between the phenomenon of war and the phenomenon of slavery, and the two literatures actually don't really speak very well to each other. And so I'm thinking about a project to study, over a few hundred years, the interconnections and interrelations between war and slavery and the ways in which one has fueled the other and vice versa. Constantly expanding the Centre for Grand Strategy. We've got all these new projects coming up and lots of new opportunities to engage with policy audiences and thinking about different strands. But really, my main priority in the next year is to get to some more conferences. I really miss talking to people face to face and sharing ideas and learning from other people's work.
Curse you, COVID. Yes. Thank you so much. Those are what you're going to be doing next just sounds so brilliant. Thank you so much for letting us know. This is Joe Crowder. I've been speaking with Maeve Ryan. Her new book, Humanitarian Governance and the British Anti-Slavery World System. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.